Hi, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? What are their go-to products? Are they obsessive about their appearance, or is it low on their list of priorities? And how have time and experience changed the way they feel about the way they look? Today's guest is our first ever male guest, and he's one of my favourite men in beauty. Ask anyone in the industry, Terry Barber is a makeup artist's makeup artist. Like many of the best and most trusted, he started on counter at MAC at its first ever UK retailer. And since then, between running the glam squad backstage at fashion shows, making up Grace Jones and a pre-make under Pamela Anderson, he has climbed to be MAC's global head of artistry. A Welsh working class lad come London club kid, his beauty references are expansive, quirky, and irreverent, and are revealed in what is easily my favourite Instagram account. There's no one with whom I'd rather talk all things beauty. But before that, a massive thank you to Clinique, who are sponsoring this series of Beyond the Bathroom. Clinique, where great-looking skin begins. So let's do it, Terry Barber.
Hiya, Sal.
Hello.
Can I record that and have that as my bio?
Well, you can link to the podcast. It now exists for all eternity. There are very few people who would disagree with any of it, I would say. Let's start with growing up. You and I have discussed this before, but I would love to get it on record. We're from roughly the same part of the world.
Yeah.
And women in that part of the world, beauty, or rather grooming and appearances, plays a certain role in the culture there.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think it was that generation of working class women generally. I mean, for me, like for my mum, beauty was occasional. You know, I think she had the same blue eyeshadow that she'd had. It was probably Yardley. You know, from one of those dodgy chemists.
Yeah.
She had that in the bathroom with some...
Like a single blue.
A single blue. And I actually love that blue.
Yeah, it's great.
I refer to that blue
frosty.
A lot. That Wedgwoody grey, like hardly any pigment in it.
Slightly ill wash of colour.
Ill. And that, you know, that applicator that was just waxy and falling off. And the same, I think she had a Yardley compact, you know, with a rim around it. And again, the sweaty puff to apply it.
Yeah.
And that was all she had. And that was only for occasions. Family weddings, that blue would be on the eye. So, I mean, even though I do makeup now, I wasn't really around makeup when I was a kid, apart from my sister.
Sister bigger than you?
2 years, yeah.
And so did you used to watch her get ready?
Yeah. Well, and also it was the 70s, and I remember she went through a bit of a, you know, Olivia Newton-John in Grease, Sandy.
Yeah.
Sandy going from good girl to bad girl phase. Mm-hmm. She had those skin tight satin trousers. Mm-hmm. I remember her lying on the floor and me having to do the fly up with the pliers because they were so tight. She had this amazing Farah flicked hair. You know, when it was just the hairline.
Hot brush.
Hot brush, tongued. I stood on them once. I was off school for 2 weeks. So I remember that sort of glamour and a lot of non-glamour because I was surrounded by a lot of like matriarchs, Welsh matriarchs, who would never wear makeup. Beauty was a vanity, you know. Beauty was fantasy, it wasn't.
And so did it feel quite rebellious to you, beauty, then?
I really didn't discover beauty. Because I think my childhood was two halves. I was a gay kid who went to school, who went to a comprehensive school in Wales. I had to be under the radar. Mm-hmm.
Safer.
So I had to look very kind of unassuming and mm-hmm. quite normal. Mm-hmm. But then I remember Newport, South Wales. I went to art school. I did a foundation course. And I arrived at that building in Newport. And it was like all the freaks, the fabulous freaks of Wales had turned up to do a foundation art course. There were punks, there was mods, there was rockabillies, there were goths. And I was like, okay, this is what I want. You know, this is me from now on.
Why did you want that?
Because I'd always felt like a complete outsider when I was a kid. You know, I mean, the only gay in the village syndrome. Mm-hmm. So I was always, you know, and I'd always, I mean, talking about kind of beauty and glamour, I mean, I guess when I should have been out playing rugby, I was indoors watching Bette Davis films. So I'd always been, you know, I watched all of those old movies.
Okay, so like what? Baby Jane, I mean, that is a makeup film.
Yeah.
Isn't
well,
it?
And I loved Bette Davis because I liked her because she was unusual.
Yeah.
I think of all those big screen actresses of that time, she was the most unusual. But to me, that was beautiful. And I've had a love of very unique beauty ever since. It's what captivates me most.
So do you think it was maybe your sense of otherness was drawn to those other faces?
Yeah.
Those slightly offbeat. Yeah, because Bette Davis is weird looking by conventional beauty
yeah.
standards. Eyes like saucers, tiny
yeah.
mouth.
You know, those big kind of really almost overly deep eyelids.
Yeah.
Which I think she's probably put a bit of Vaseline on.
Yeah.
So they were shiny.
Who else did you love from that period?
I mean, I loved Marilyn, obviously, but especially in Niagara, because mm-hmm. just no one had seen anything like that. Mm-hmm. She was like, you know, pin-up, mannequin, amazing.
Marlena Dietrich.
Marlena, yeah.
Yeah.
And I just like all the myths about Marlena as well. Apparently, I don't know if this is true or not, she used to use her hair as facelift tapes.
Explain.
And apparently she used to just make the hairline tighter and tighter and tighter. Almost like if you turn...
What's now known as a Croydon facelift.
A Croydon facelift.
Yeah.
Or like early trainer tapes. But apparently she used to do it with hair.
Wow. Imagine the stress on her scalp.
That dedication and all the myths. You know, Liz Taylor. Amazing. I was always fascinated by Liz Taylor because...
Me too.
Her makeup changed after doing Cleopatra.
Uh-huh.
Before that, she was kind of classic Hollywood bombshell.
Yeah.
After Cleopatra, she got into, you know, that blue eyeshadow we talked
yeah.
to my mum's?
Yeah.
She it almost looked like she was wearing that for other parts.
Yeah.
But if you watch the VIPs, which was after Cleopatra, Liz Taylor looked like she's wearing the Cleopatra makeup.
And it's funny because when you take that makeup out of context, out of the Egyptian kind of epic context,
yeah.
it looks quite brassy.
Yeah.
You know, it looks quite
and sometimes quite
70s
tart. Quite mumsy. Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. And best eyes ever. Most
yeah.
beautiful eyes
yeah.
you've ever seen.
Don't think they were violet, though. I think that's a myth.
Yeah. But as myths go, I'll take
yeah.
it. Yeah.
And I kind of liked Liz Taylor later on as well, when she was a bit more bawdy.
Oh, yeah, me too.
You know, she was boozy and
oh, yeah.
bawdy. And
yeah, me too. One of my all-time favourites.
Yeah.
So you took this love of the unconventional to an unconventional place in fashion college.
Yeah.
Or in art college, sorry. Did you know you wanted to get out of Wales, ultimately?
I think I had to get out of Wales. I don't think there was a choice. Because I mean, I wanted to work to be a creative. I mean, the only place you could be was London at the time.
100%.
You know, I mean, I was that, I call it the 80s migration of freaks to
yeah,
London.
Yeah.
Because
no,
it's
had
where
to
you
move.
Were safe. And I arrived in London and it was the concrete jungle. And for me, it was like wrapping a comfortable blanket around myself.
Me too.
The anonymity. Almost the kind of grittiness of it, even the dirt and the filth of it, for me was like heaven.
I felt exactly the same. There was just all the things people hate about London were the things I loved about it.
Yeah.
Nobody knew me. Nobody cared about me. Nobody
no.
was in each other's business.
Yeah.
You know?
Heaven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so.
And now I'm slightly disillusioned with London at the moment because I find it a little bit sterile.
Well, you also have to have a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I think when we came to London, I think when we came to London, if you made it your business to meet interesting people and to go out, and you could go out with a fiver, especially if you were a girl.
Or nothing.
But yeah, or nothing, especially if you were a girl, people just buy you drinks. You could go out, and if you made it your business to talk to interesting people, interesting things happened to you.
Yeah.
But I think now you need an awful lot of money to make things happen for
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Which you didn't then.
No. I mean, I remember, I mean, because when I was in Wales, I did actually get a Prince's Trust grant, But I got a Prince's Trust grant to do a very minimal makeup course in London.
Where did you go to study?
Complexions International,
yes!
The London School of Makeup.
At Complexions on Lamb's Conduit Street.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sharon Dowsett went there as well.
And Jane Bradley.
Yeah. And I managed to score enough money to do a week's course, crash course. I turned up with body shop brushes.
They were the best brushes on the high street at
but
the time.
But they expected you to turn up with kind of the theatre shop brushes, you know, the
and a brush
stuff.
Belt.
And I turned up with Barbara Daly Colourings body shop brushes.
I remember them.
But I produced some bloody good makeup with those brushes, I have to say.
And what did you learn on that course?
I think it was like a day makeup, an evening makeup, a makeup for deeper skin tones. And then maybe a kind of fancy editorial special effects makeup. I learned some good things, though. I remember them teaching me how to mix products together, mm-hmm. like mix eyeshadows.
Which you do
together.
A lot.
I
has
do
become
a
trademark of yours, yeah.
Yeah, I'm an absolute scientist when it comes to, like, mixing things. But, I mean, after that, I didn't get a job in makeup straight away.
So what did you do?
I worked in Top Man Oxford Circus on T-shirts. I remember Andy Peters was the radio top shop DJ at the time.
Yeah.
I'll see how long ago it was.
Yeah.
Do you remember that, the absolute prime corner of Oxford Circus?
Absolutely, yeah.
I worked for the body shop for a while. Didn't go well. I worked for Next. Trouble is, I was going out to clubs every night because in London, all the club nights were in the week.
Yes.
No one in London ever went out on the weekend mm-hmm. because that was for tourists. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was always wasted.
And so what, I mean, I was wasted throughout my entire retail career.
Yeah.
And so was everyone else, it has to be said.
Yeah, got fired from a few. It was just too much.
What impact did going out to clubs have on your aesthetic?
I always say that was my education. That was like my university degree.
How so?
Because I learned about styling. I learned about subculture. I learned about the underground. You know, all the references now that I use in my work mm-hmm. all come from going to clubs and, you know, I remember going to Taboo Club and, you know, seeing Lee Bowery spinning around in the middle of a dance floor with fringed ping pong balls as eyes. And mm-hmm. I kind of, you know, my hero of stylist, Judy Blaine, mm-hmm. You know, sat on a stool looking like Clockwork Orange with a string of pearls around his neck. It just taught me about kind of style, subculture, underground, the idea of alternative. I've mixed a lot of experiences in my life kind of together to create the aesthetic I have now.
The other thing I always associate with you, which sort of taps into that time of going out, is that you are almost obsessed with the ritual that people, and specifically, I suppose, women have of getting ready to go out.
Yeah.
It's the best bit of the night, right?
Yeah.
Isn't it? Getting
and
ready.
That's what,
you
and
love that, don't
and
you?
And I've actually learned, I think I've learned my craft from that. The techniques I adopt now in makeup are, I feel, what people might do in real life. You know, when you put a pencil across your lash line, but for me it's when you smudge it and move it and like melt it into the skin or, you know, you quite like it when it's got a little bit of creasiness in it because it's a bit more cool and it's a bit more grungy.
Yeah, makeup that looks like it's had a fight in the ladies.
Yeah. So the ritual of how people put on makeup and what they do to it and how they tweak it is kind of what I'm most influenced by.
When you won, we are both very honoured to have won the CW Achievers Award in our careers.
Yeah.
And when you won the CW Achievers Award, your speech was so beautiful. It was so great. And the reason I loved it so much, it was very eloquently and beautifully done, but the reason I loved it so much was that you really said that your award went to all the girls and the women that you have been lucky enough to kind of touch their faces, ask them how they get ready. So that would have come from counterwork. So tell us about that. And I suppose for anybody a lot younger than us, just what it meant when Mac landed in the UK and you were on counter. That was a moment.
Yeah, it was a moment. That was it was like a little doubt. It was a little kind of subculture in the corner of Harvey Nichols ground floor. And I'd always loved Harvey Nichols anyway. Because that's where Shuamura was and that's where Cosmetics a la Carte was. You know, it was
I've still got brushes I bought from that Shuamura counter in Harvey Nichols. They're so well made.
They're perfect.
Yeah.
And they've got that short but not short handle.
Yes. Which short silver really handle with like an orange amber bristle.
Yeah.
But they're still perfect. Yeah. And I bought them in Harvey Nichols.
Yeah. They were made to last. Yeah, I've got them.
Beautiful.
Yeah. I practically got security tags on them for when I go backstage at shows. Because if anybody nicks a vintage shoe brush, I'm going to send the police around.
Absolutely. So did you know when you heard Mac was coming, did you know I have to work there?
Yeah. And I'd heard about Mac because Mac was very word of mouth, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, it wasn't advertised. I mean, there was obviously no social media, but there was this buzz about it. You know, Linda uses the Spice lip liner. All the supermodels use the Spice lip liner.
And RuPaul's involvement and all of that.
So there was this buzz about it, and it had already opened because how naive I was. I thought I'd go in and get an application form to apply. And I think the counter had only been open for about a week or two. It was jam-packed with people. I think they had about three staff on counter who were just like...
Yeah, having an
like they were at a firing range.
Yeah.
And someone... This girl from Monica, called Monica from Canada, who was like an area manager, came out and she went, "Do you want a job?" I went, "Yep." And she said, "What do you know about Mac?" I went, "Well, I got this brush that I bought, which it's all I use to do the socket of the eye." And she went, "You're hired. Go and get store approval now. When can you start?"
So did you start straight away?
Yeah. I didn't have any formal interview. I think I had a kind of store approval by Harvey Nichols.
Wow.
But I pretty much started straight away.
And so those women you paid tribute to in your speech, that started then, right? Suddenly you've got your hands on women's faces of all colours, ages, styles.
Backgrounds, cultures, desires, you know.
And what have they taught you, those women?
It sounds a bit wanky, but...
That's all right.
It's kind of how makeup needs to affect someone emotionally, how someone needs to feel, which is not always perfect. And it's not always a lot of makeup. And it's not always a complete transformation. It could be something small, some little detail. I always feel with being a makeup artist, if you're working with models is different than mannequins. You know, they're there for you to do anything on. But with regular people, for me, it's always like there's a secret code and you have to sort of tap it. You have to unlock it somehow. What is the little tweak on the face or that little moment? What is the little smudge on the liner? What is the little blur on the lip? What is the little overdraw? What's the little underdraw? What is that? So you have to kind of crack that code of... you're going to see that person suddenly go, oh, that's it.
And
that's
that's the transformation, isn't it? Because it's the transformation of mood, of confidence, of self-esteem in that moment. It's not the literal transformation of no makeup versus loads.
No. Well, the transformation moment is very often just the indulgence of the makeup artist. It's not about the subject matter. I've taught myself to care about the subject matter. And you can tell, I can always tell when I'm doing someone's makeup. You can see, you can read the signs of when you're getting it right and when they're like, this is not right, this is not me.
Yeah, oh, that horrible moment when someone looks in the mirror and you just know they hate it.
Yeah.
They feel terrible about themselves. It's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's horrible.
It's really bad.
But it was kind of great at the time at Mac in the 90s because everybody kind of wanted a transformation.
Yeah.
I mean, we used to sell, like Studio Fix powder.
Yeah.
You know, the powder foundation all in one.
Yeah.
People couldn't believe that a product like that actually existed. They're like, no, this is a pressed powder. There's no way that's going to make me look perfect. Because it was like an all-in-one, wasn't it? Like a kind of cake.
About to be reformulated, I think I'm allowed to say.
It's quite good, though.
Yeah.
I tested it.
I love StudioFX.
Me too. And I tested the new one and I was like, you're messing with a classic.
Yeah.
Good.
Good.
Just a little bit more.
Less talky.
Yeah, a bit more luxe.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, StudioFX powder. I mean, it's literally like you used to put it on their face and they'd look like an editorial, you know, like an airbrush.
Yeah.
Cosmo cover.
Yeah.
And they're like, what is this witchcraft? You know, what is this magic trick you're playing?
And do you think you developed a kind of a trademark aesthetic there on that counter? Did you become known for a certain kind of makeup?
Yeah, I think with MAC, what we gave people was a very different almost identity to what other brands were doing at the time. Because I think other brands were selling luxury, weren't they?
And MAC was, it has to be said, in this very basic artistry packaging.
Yeah.
Just black plastic. It was all about what was inside.
And I think what they did is, you know, they sold classic neutrals next to sort of stranger editorial fashion colours. And I think it was that combination which people loved. I mean, it's been copycatted so much since.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, I'm proud of the brand, you know. I mean,
absolutely.
They've ridden so many storms of changing trends. They've gone in and out of fashion, in and out of public approval. Oh, what's happening with MAC? You know, oh, they're not the same as they were. They're still thriving.
I think. Well, it's still the number one makeup brand in the world.
Yeah, which
I mean, let's not
which
forget.
Is something.
It's still number one. I when I wrote Pretty Iconic, and you and I talked a lot during that period.
Mm.
When I wrote Pretty Iconic, MAC was the brand where I had to do the biggest cull, because if you're not careful, you can easily put 30 MAC products in a book about iconic products.
Yeah.
You know, you can do Spice and you can do StudioFX. You can do so many products. I think I got at one point, you can do Groundwork, Paint Pot, you can do Face and Body. You know, you can go on and on and on, because these were products that just didn't really exist in that way.
No.
Until they were launched by MAC.
Yeah. I mean, Face and Body was an interesting one.
It's still one of the best.
It was like a watery formula, but it had coverage.
I mean, it's still one of my favourite foundations ever.
Before that, there was lots of very light liquid foundations, but they kind of did nothing. I did like the Calvin Klein ones, though.
Calvin Klein was a great brand, wasn't
it? I loved that.
You and I always fall down this hole, don't we, when we talk? We always like reminisce about brands that were really incredible that don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, it was Diane Kendall, was it not? Diane Kendall devised that brand, if I remember rightly, and it was all sheer washes of something.
Yeah. But it was cool.
The eyeshadows you could barely see, the lipsticks you could barely see, but the colours were so gorgeous.
Yeah, it was cool as well, though, wasn't it? It wasn't just kind of natural, but...
No, it wasn't natural. Because
there was something almost a bit Corinne Day about it.
Yeah, it wasn't natural. You're right, because you would have green eyeshadow, say.
Yeah.
But it was just the sort of sheerness, the wash of it that was so kind of undone and elegant.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't really a neutrals brand. They had proper colour, but it was just sort of watercolour.
Yeah, I just ordered... I just got from eBay a set of Ultima 2, the Naked lipsticks that Kevin did, O'Quinn.
Yes.
And I can't use them. They stink.
They stink. And but actually, they'll like be really talky and horrible in formulation.
But I kind of almost like the talky nastiness of them.
But absolutely groundbreaking.
Yeah. And super, I was surprised because some of them are all, because I think Kevin did colours. We was the first to do nudes that worked across all skin tones.
Yes.
And some of them look quite mustardy and
They're really,
like really yellowy.
Yeah, like ochre sort of a colour.
Really cool.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. So I suppose I'd like to know more about that. Kevin O'Quinn, obviously just such an idol, but anybody who is really serious about beauty, if they don't admire Kevin O'Quinn, they're not paying attention. But who were your other influences at the time? I know you love Dick Page, don't you?
I love Dick Page because for me... Dick Page represented that moment. I loved kind of 90s, you know, Helmut Lang and Calvin Klein, especially the Helmut Lang shows, because I just remember that time he almost kind of took all the coverage off the skin. So they, you know, it's models with like very scrubbed faces, and then they, you know, he'd put like a redness in the cheek. and they had this really chic kind of brick lipstick on.
He's a beautiful makeup
and he'd
artist.
Put the kind of brick lipstick also on the eyelids, so the eyes look kind of sore but gorgeous. He's been a big influence on me, his kind of sense of nuance. I love a nuanced makeup artist.
He's a beautiful makeup artist. Yeah. I mean, he's kind of a genius.
Yeah.
If you want to go into YouTube, a previous episode of In the Bathroom is with Dick Page.
Oh, I've seen it.
It was so great that we just had to make it a two-parter because he's just, you can listen to him forever.
I watched it immediately.
Yeah, he's very much in your wheelhouse, isn't he? Yeah. Aesthetically.
I was very much influenced by him and his eye for very nuanced details. And I just think so stylish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also Stéphane Marais, you know.
Genius.
Because for me, all the work that Stéphane did with, you know, Peter Lindbergh, like that dirtiness, mm-hmm. that gorgeous
grainy
dirtiness. Yeah, almost like models looking like modern silent movie stars.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
You know, it was looking doing like that Ellen von Unworth sort of.
Yeah. Time. Looking like you've got coal dust on the eyes and look, you've got this really, really bitten dark lip.
Let's take a quick pause on this episode to thank our series sponsor, Clinique. Clinique believes that great-looking skin doesn't have to be complicated, and obviously I quite agree. Over 50 years ago, Clinique changed the beauty industry forever by being one of the first to offer a dermatologist-developed skincare ritual outside of the dermatologist's office, the iconic three-step routine, cleanse, exfoliate, and moisturise. Clinique was the first premium brand I ever owned, and truly, there hasn't ever been a single time in over 3.5 decades since, where I haven't had something Clinique in my bathroom cabinet. From the original Clinique computer that helped women understand their skin, to today's innovative clinical reality diagnostic tool, Clinique has always led the way in helping you to truly understand what your skin needs. They offer solutions for every skin type and concern, and Clinique's makeup and skincare products are dermatologist tested, allergy tested, and 100% fragrance free. Discover your best skin at Clinique, where great-looking skin begins. What I think you've done very cleverly, your Instagram, I was saying to a mutual friend of ours earlier on, Nicola Chapman, I was saying if ever I meet anybody who wants to enter the beauty industry, who wants to work as a makeup artist or a beauty writer or product development or whatever, one of the things I always say to them is to go and follow you on Instagram. And a lot of that is because of you and the cleverness and the humour of your account, and obviously the details will be in the show notes. But also, and I'd be interested on your thoughts on it, also I worry that there are no references anymore, that it's, you can't just reference someone else's Instagram account, right?
No.
When you're doing makeup, it has to be bigger than that, and references are everywhere.
Yeah.
It might be an exhibition, it might be a film, it might be a bin liner. Was that your intention when you started that account, or how did that come about?
Well, I resisted doing any form of social media.
I know,
media
you were very
years.
Down on it.
And I think when I started it, it was very much in the kind of, it was the moment when celebrity culture and reality TV shows,
which you are not a fan,
took off. Yeah. And I thought, now would be a good time and go in and be a bit anarchic. And I always wanted to be a bit niche. I don't mind being on the fringe. I'd like to speak to like minds rather than appeal to everybody. And I thought I'd quite like to make it quite British, make it quite involve humour. And also it'd be a little bit of a kind of take on pop art, you know, like Andy Warhol's soup can. It's so normal that it's ridiculous. And I also it just represents my brain, really. It's all a bit yin and yang. I like extremes. I like, you know, high end meets very low end.
Yeah.
If I see that blue eyeshadow, that for me could be very 50s couture, but it could also be, you know, Bette Lynch in Coronation Street.
Yeah.
My brain works like that. So I thought, let's do something that's kind of a little bit anarchic for the moment that it's in, because it went right through that 2016 aesthetic and I was doing like...
And what comes first, the still image or the makeup image? So essentially, Terry's Instagram is a large selection of images where each tile is sort of split into two. And half of the tile is the reference point, which could be a cigarette stuffed out in an ashtray. And the other half of the tile, might be then how it manifests in a makeup look. And so a kind of nicotine stained eyelid, for example. So which comes first?
To be quite honest, I don't plan it. And it depends when I get pictures. You know, I don't always have a kind of stock of pictures I've used. I repurpose loads of old kind of backstage show pictures and like zoomed in on them.
And try and remember what inspired them at
yeah,
the time.
So I don't necessarily do it with a plan. It's quite spontaneous. And it depends when I get images. It's different for me on social media because I'm not someone who can do my own makeup on camera.
Yes, exactly that. So I wanted to talk to you
about
that.
So I can't post regularly, you know. For me, I like to drop something occasionally. Quite like that, being a bit elusive.
Yes, but that's a good point because apart from being a man and so not able to be massively versatile in terms of makeup you wear, you're also not a makeup wearer.
No.
So there are lots of male makeup artists who absolutely are makeup wearers and we see them out and about and they look fabulous and, you know, we're all for it.
Yeah.
Why don't you wear makeup?
I mean, I obviously did in the 80s.
Sure.
I was obsessed with Boy George.
And what would you wear?
So I would wear Rimmel Pale Biscuit foundation.
In the tube?
It was the only one that goths used because it was the only one pale enough.
Uh-huh.
Powder that with talcum powder.
Remember that well.
I used to nick my sister every Christmas, got an Estee Lauder gift set.
The massive coffre with like 48 eyeshadows in it. Yeah.
And I used to get the brown and that used to go down my cheek, up my temples. And I used to blank my lips out. I guess it was a bit kind of Bowie, Gary Numan, Boy George.
New romantic in vibe.
I would say if I was to classify myself in the early 80s, it was more veering towards new romantic.
Yeah.
But then I had different phases, like George was wearing all of Boy London, so all of a sudden I was wearing all of Boy London. I was obsessed with George. He was my Bowie.
I still have a Boy London T-shirt. Yeah. It's kept sort of bits and pieces from that time.
I remember I lost the Boy London braces because a friend of mine that I did hairdressing with, we used to drive up to Birmingham from South Wales to go to clubs on a Friday night. And on the way back, the fan belt broke and we had to use my braces.
Oh my God, I would have died. They were such a lot of money, weren't they, in those days? So when did you stop wearing makeup? When did you decide that your look was going to be makeup free?
I didn't really make that decision. I mean, it just started not to suit me after a while. You know, and the makeup, I did makeup in the 90s, but I guess my 80s and 90s were quite different. My 80s, I wanted to be a freak and I wanted to shock everybody and piss people off. Because I think dressing up and being flamboyant that time, we were more, I think in the 80s compared to now, we didn't really want to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to be outsiders. Mm-hmm. We wanted to piss people off. So I don't want you to approve of me. I want you to be shocked by me. The 90s, I wanted to be a bit more sexy. So I think I hit the fake tan.
I can't even imagine you fake tanned.
I put a little bit of self-tan on my face every time I shave my head. But I used those Clarins.
Yes, great.
Tanning drops.
Yeah.
In a bit of moisturiser.
Yeah.
I swear by those.
Yes.
Because it just takes... It takes the blue off the top of my head and it takes the gammon out of the front of my face.
I always think a bit of self-tan drop, if you have the wherewithal and the energy to do it after a big night out before you go to bed, to just chuck some in your night cream, put it on, the next day you will feel so much better than you would have done.
Yeah.
because you wake up, you look like death without it. But if
well,
you've
just make
done that,
the white of your eye just a little bit whiter.
Yes, that's what it
the
is.
Pink of your lip a little bit pinker.
Yeah, yeah. So you still do that?
Yeah.
Every time you
shave? Because I wet shave my head and it's just a little bit blue. So I just do a little bit of...
What are your other little secret concessions to beauty and makeup?
Not a lot these days. I mean, I tend to use whatever I get free in a goodie bag. I've just got a tube of moisturiser by Typology in a goodie
lovely
bag.
Brand,
it's really
yeah.
nice. Mm. And I like it because it's quite matte. Mm-hmm. I guess being a guy, I'm very conscious of the kind of texture of my skin with skincare. Mm-hmm. I don't like to look waxy. Mm-hmm. I don't like to look... Yeah, I think waxy is the word. I like a moisturiser that keeps me matte. Mm-hmm. I don't like shine. But then I don't like dry.
No. Horrible to look dry, isn't it? It's just not a nice look to look dry, especially as you get older.
Yeah.
I think I look terrible when I look dry. Yeah. I look in the mirror and I'm really dry around my eyes. I would have to just grab a moisturiser because it's death. What do you think is the most instantly transformative of makeup products? If you meet a woman, she's like, I've never worn makeup. What do I need? What's the one thing that you just think, that's a banker? That will sort you out.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm a fan of blush.
Yes.
And I think if you want something that's instant.
I so agree.
I think it's a blush, but it's getting that tone right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that, I mean, everybody's looking for that perfect colour of blush, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And I think it's always a mixture of cool and warm. It's neither one or the other, but both.
I'm the biggest fan of a neutral undertone. Yeah. I love a neutral undertone.
Yeah.
If ever I have to have my makeup done professionally, they say, oh, what would you like, a warm brown smoky eye? I'm like, no, I want a neutral.
Yeah.
I just love that clutch biting point between warm and cool.
Yeah. And I'm the same with lip colours as well.
Yeah.
That's why I mix a lot, you know, in my kit when I'm like doing my work.
Because everything's too yellow or too pink.
Yeah. I've even got an old MAC dark khaki green lipstick.
Oh, wow.
And I sometimes mix that into neutrals to just cool them down a little bit, especially with deeper skin tones.
Nice.
I like khaki. And I think there are certain undertones which don't really get used in makeup anymore. Don't you think everything for a while just has gone really pasty?
I find everything too warm at the moment.
Yeah.
I think these days when a new product comes out, and I'm obviously very fortunate, I'll get sent all the colours.
Yeah.
I find them all a bit too warm. Everything has gone a bit yellow.
I call it the hangover from 2016.
Yeah. It's very much of that age. I'm hoping that cool tones and neutrals will come back. There's just something so elegant about it.
They're creeping in, I think.
I think they're creeping in. There have been a few sort of runaway success, like palette moments in recent months that have been cool toned. And I love it because there's something so elegant, I think, about a cool tone.
And grown up.
It's a bit kind of, you know, Belle de Jour.
Yeah.
You know, I like that look. Yeah. I like that cool look. I don't like a rusty, bronzy thing. It's not for me.
No. I just think what happened 2016, obviously, suddenly the only reference, but we talked about people not referencing, the last decade had a lot to answer for. Celebrity culture was hardcore. Only reference point were either a Kardashian sister or a contestant from Love Island.
And
those became super commercial, and even like really classy brands started to change their palettes to fit it.
It's a hard balance to get right, I think, because I know that you love a brassy face of makeup. It's not a snobbery.
No.
Well, maybe it is a snobbery, but it's not a class snobbery. It's a different kind of snobbery. But I know you like... I mean, I don't know what the word would be now, what the appropriate word would be now, but you like a tarty faceful.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not that you're objecting to. It's a specific kind of glossy...
It's just kind of... It's just that over-perfected, filtered, ring light. And also, it's that one face fits all. That's what happened. It was like, oh, here's a tutorial on YouTube on contour. But basically, at the end of it, you're all going to have exactly the same
shape.
Regardless of whether you want that.
Whether you've got a wide nose, a narrow nose, an upturned nose, you need it all to have the same nose.
And you have to correct your face in order to fit in this ideal. I'm like, what is this, the 1950s again? Are we having beauty ideals? I just think it was a really dark moment for beauty, personally.
So do I. And I wrote about it a lot at the time, and my views were not popular.
No.
But it just felt so Victorian to me.
Yeah.
It just felt really, really old-fashioned.
Yeah.
This idea that we all had to kind of facet our faces like emeralds, you know, and they all had to be the same shape at the end of it. It just felt so... It just felt so dated, and it felt at odds with everything that we had been working towards.
Yeah.
Suddenly we were like chiseling away at a big nose or whatever it was.
And it just made young people look really old. The styling is old to me.
I think there's been a real... What I have found quite gratifying in the past couple of years is that there has been a trend. I'm not even sure if it's a trend because it's stuck around, but a trend for makeup that looks good in person again.
Yeah.
Because the phase you're talking about, really, makeup existed to look good in a picture.
Yeah.
And you would see people up close and you'd be like, whoa.
Wow. Yeah. You look like that highlighter makes you look like Miss Havisham.
You look 20 years older than you are.
Yeah.
And you don't look cool. You don't look like you know what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
You look like you just sit at home and take your picture.
Yeah. Well, we lost cool for a while, didn't we?
Yeah, I think so. Cool.
It was about being perfect. I mean, for me, it just felt like the bloody beauty Olympics. It's like, don't leave the house unless your eyebrows are on fleek. It was like, oh my God.
I mean, that's a terrible word, though.
Beauty does mean girls.
Yeah.
You know, it just felt aggressive.
But what impact do you think that had on artistry? The reason I ask that is that the period you're talking about, or just before it, everyone became a makeup artist, right?
Yeah.
Which was both a brilliant thing and a slightly troubling thing. It was a brilliant thing insofar as it sort of democratized makeup. If you were good at doing makeup, suddenly you had an online portfolio. You could just join an app. And as long as you had a smartphone, you could put your artistry out there. And some really brilliant artists come out.
And that's the thing I loved about social media.
Yeah.
As you said, democratising it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, when I started doing makeup, it was just really elite. Only the elite got
totally there. Agree. Posh people.
Yeah.
Often.
You know, I spent 15 years working in, like, shops, mainly to fund my nights out.
Yeah.
But, you know, I knew that I wasn't going to go straight into a job in makeup. So, I loved the fact that it's done that. But then it kind of slipped into kind of, you know, people getting recognition for only being able to do one type of makeup. So it suddenly became, it got called makeup artistry, but it suddenly wasn't makeup artistry. It was just someone doing their own makeup with a ring light, sticking the Paris filter on it.
And about 12 eyeshadows.
Here you go. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you feel encouraged by that's happening right now? What is, because the nature of being global head of artistry at Mac means you're always having to look, right, at what's happening, what's cool, what's coming through.
Yeah.
What's exciting you?
I just think there's a new generation who are going, okay, hold on a minute. I mean, okay, you lot back in the 70s and 80s, you had Bowie and you were a lot of punk and you had that subculture. What have we had? And I just think they're suddenly they're referencing again. Like to me, it's like the Pinterest board generation. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're referencing everything, you know. It's like, just talk about the 90s, like we used to talk about the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, I think it's great. I think, I feel that we're at the start of a new wave period in beauty again, which is great.
Are you still turned on by beauty after this many decades?
Not that much. I don't really follow a lot on social media. I I still like people, I tend to like the people who do very nuanced work, who do that quiet, slightly quieter, under the radar beauty.
But are you still turned on? I feel like I know the answer to this because I've sat in many a pub or cafe with you. Are you still turned on by beauty when you just see a woman walk past you with interesting makeup on an interesting face?
Yes, because to me, I like style. So I don't like beauty just isolated.
Yeah.
I don't want to analyse it. Oh, that eyeshadow's great or that lip colour's great. Yeah. I like the whole. I like... And it's another reason why I did what I did on Instagram, because I wanted to put beauty in more of a wider context.
Yeah.
You know, I like, you know, it's like when you watch beauty on a film, the film's not about beauty. Like you watch a David Lynch film, like I watched Blue Velvet again the other night. You know, Isabella Rossellini with that kind of glittery cobalt eyeshadow and the red lip.
It's like Cabaret. Cabaret's not about beauty, but it's absolutely a beauty film.
Yeah. I watched again The Boyfriend, because it's one of my favourite style films of all time. You know, Ken Russell with Twiggy. Mm-hmm. But it was Twiggy just at the beginning of the 70s, and it was Bieber.
Yeah.
And you could tell it's just all Bieber.
Yeah.
It was the Bieber eye shape.
Yeah.
You know, the
kind
Bieber.
Of moon round.
Yeah. It was
slightly
almost like
Bette Davis.
The 70s meets the 30s.
Yeah.
So beautiful.
Yeah.
So I think I have more interested in makeup in the context of style rather than just the actual makeup itself, if that makes sense. Like I don't look after picture of, oh, here's a perfect eyeliner, oh, this is a perfect lip. I don't find that interesting. I like a story wrapped around it, I guess.
Our very good mutual friend, Sam Chapman, always says that...
My former muse at Mac.
Yes, very much so. She was your protege.
We were in the back room doing her makeup while we should have been serving customers.
It was always her face, wasn't it?
Always.
You just grab.
Yeah.
Let me just put this on.
I mean, it's that kind of face you can just put anything on.
It's true. She always says, The makeup I always admire on people is the makeup that's been thrown on.
Yeah.
While people are on their way out to do something more interesting.
Yeah.
Those are the faces that stop her in her tracks, and the style she admires when someone's obviously just chucked it on. And
yeah. Yeah. Accidents and mistakes in makeup which look good are always the best. You know, the smudge of mascara on the eyelid where someone thought, I quite like that, I'm not going to fix it.
Yeah.
Or the clump in the mascara. A bit of eyebrow hair going the wrong way, you know, a bit of a lip worn off in a place. I mean, to me, that's all, cause it's charming, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's charming.
Yeah.
Whereas to me, just an image of a pinpoint airbrushed perfect makeup, there's no soul to it. There's no story behind it.
And how do you feel in this industry about aging? As you see...
It pisses me off.
Okay, tell me why you're pissed off.
Because why, for instance, if we talk about older, and obviously mainly older women, why is the conversation about looking younger, why is that the only conversation? And it seems to be the only priority is de-aging or youthful. Or there's a phrase which really kills my pig... Age appropriate.
Uh-huh.
What?
Yes.
Can I swear? The fuck does that
mean? Go ahead.
What does that mean? A, it's got the word appropriate in it, which immediately I'm resistant to.
Yeah.
But what is that? Who decides what that appropriate is? You know, who are you? Like, if you see an older woman, how do you know she wasn't a punk at the end of the 70s?
Yes.
How do you know she didn't go to raves in the 90s?
Yes.
And so on. Why do you assume that you know what her character is in order that you're going to say, this is the look that's appropriate for you?
This is an absolute...
It's patronising and vile.
This is an absolute piss boiler, I agree.
Yeah.
I was talking to a brand about 18 months ago, and they were asking me what I thought of their latest campaign for menopausal skincare.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed me the photographs in this campaign, and I was like, these women would have gone through the menopause at least 20 years ago.
Yeah.
At least. They are the kinds of women who are menopausal now went to the hacienda.
Yeah.
Like, why have you got these very, very mature women who, by the way, I'm here for those women being in campaigns. Great, use them in campaigns, but not around the menopause because you've got the age totally wrong. But why have you got these very mature ladies speaking to women who still go to Ibiza with all their girlfriends every summer, who go to Glastonbury every year, who were at the Hacienda, who were at Acid House Club?
Yeah.
And the answer, unfortunately, is that these decisions are being made by 30-year-old people.
Yeah.
Who just think, if you're old, you're old, you just other.
Yeah, and you wear tawny rose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's just awful. I mean, I'd rather people not talk about age.
Me too.
It's like just, because I think also we're in a period where now everything feels quite boxed. You know, we have to name generations. You know, you've got Gen Z, millennial. I mean, what is that for? I just think that so people can analyse data so that they can kind of easily sell products to them. It just feels like a big marketing thing. I don't know.
I think just being neutral about it, what you're saying is the key. I was in New York this summer and I went into Glossier to get myself a deodorant. I love their deodorant. I went in to get myself a deodorant and there were all the staff were wearing like pink boiler suits. They sound worse than they were. They actually are quite cool. They were in these pink boiler suits and they were like brush belts and, you know. And there was a makeup artist there in her pink boiler suit and she had a kind of Rosie the Riveter scarf around her head.
Yeah, fab.
And she was about, I'm going to say pushing 70 would be my guess. Could have been older, could have been younger, but to me she looked about 70. And she was doing the coolest makeup there, without a doubt. She was doing this girl's makeup who was about 20. And it was really nice makeup.
Yeah.
It was really nice, cool makeup. And this woman looked great. Like, she looked brilliant.
Yeah.
She had, like, a coloured wing.
Yeah.
She had not much base on. She had a coloured wing eyeliner on. She just really looked great.
Yeah.
But what was brilliant about it was no one was talking about it. She wasn't just doing the older ladies. It just wasn't a thing. That was just her style. And that had clearly always been her style or her developing style or whatever. And it was so refreshing. She wasn't doing a promo for old lady makeup. She wasn't, you know, she was just there existing as a very stylish person in a makeup and skincare shop, just doing her own thing.
And I just think, you know, when you get older, you just become a lot more eclectic. Mm-hmm. You've collected stuff over the years. You've lived through subcultures. You've listened to different music. You have this whole kind of library of style in your brain, which you're going to, inspires you to put things together. So, I mean, in terms of age, I never really talk about it. And if I'm putting makeup on someone who's older, I don't refer to youthful. I don't refer to de-aging. It's like, we're going to make you look good. We're going to make you look cool. We're going to make you look stylish.
Yeah.
And there's not a tawny rose in sight.
No, never a tawny rose.
Or even a brown mascara.
You hate a brown mascara, do you?
I don't hate it. I always called it the Birkenstock of beauty.
Oh, my poor chest infection. The Birkenstock of beauty. I mean,
divides opinion.
It divides opinion. Yes, very much so. Terry Barber, you're my favourite person to talk to about beauty. I'm so chuffed you came here today and shared your many, many interesting thoughts on beauty. Thank you so much. And if you would like to go back into the archive, you will discover that Terry Barber is our only male guest. So glad he was the first. But there are lots of cool women you can go back and listen to. And in the meantime, thank you so much for listening. And next week I'll be back, probably with a woman. He will stand alone. Thank you so much, Terry.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Sal. It's nice talking to you outside the pub environment for a change.
Beyond the Bathroom is written and hosted by me, Sally Hughes, and is an Insanity Studios production. The head of production is Charlotte Mason, the head of digital is Ed Buckley, and the production assistant is Abby Sandler.